From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. It's the flavor of the month in education reform, performance pay. Simply put, more effective teachers get more money. Two major urban school districts are working on new teacher contracts, and those negotiations could help decide the future of performance pay. But as NPR's Larry Abramson reports, the idea is proving to be a major sticking point.
Look at things from Michelle Rhee's point of view. The chancellor of the Washington, D.C. schools is offering teachers a shot at an incredible pay increase.
40% raise in base salary. Guaranteed. Who gets a 40% raise in this day and age and in this economy?
That would push salaries over $100,000 a year, and it gets even better. Teachers who opt into Rhee's pay package would also be eligible for bonuses if their students do well. What's the catch? George Parker, head of the Washington Teachers Union, says teachers would have to give up their most prized benefit, tenure, for 1 year.
They would be required to revert back to 1 year of probation before regaining their tenure. That by far is the most controversial element of these entire contract negotiations.
After decades of opposition, many teachers' unions are finally embracing performance pay as the best hope for boosting salaries. But they're being asked to swallow some bitter pills in the process. George Parker says in the case of the D.C. contract proposal now being negotiated, performance pay is really hiding another motive.
There seems to be this simplistic approach, let's just pay them more or fire them.
And concerns about stealth motives made for very tough negotiations over another pay plan, Denver's ProComp, which was hailed as a landmark when it was approved in 2005. Teachers Union President Kim Orsetta says the effort to renegotiate ProComp this year was her toughest ever.
Our bargaining team was focusing on really creating all different kinds of supports from within the system in order to create the best teaching and learning environments for our students. And the district was looking at it from another angle.
That other angle boiled down to money. Superintendent Michael Bennett wanted ProComp to pay bigger rewards to younger teachers who felt the system gave too much to veterans. To do that, Bennett had to cut potential rewards for the union's most senior members. That's left many long-term teachers bitter as they vote on the contract. Results will be announced Tuesday. The pain of implementing performance pay is so high, some union members seem to be wondering, what have we gotten ourselves into? Still, analysts watching the growth of the performance pay tidal wave say, if you can't get teachers to buy in, don't even bother. Matthew Springer is director of the National Center on Performance Incentives at Vanderbilt University.
Without teacher involvement, without teacher buy-in, any type of reform is destined to fail.
Springer hopes to learn if these plans do what they're really supposed to, improve student achievement. He says right now each side can claim their proposal will help students because
there is no research base. There is no true evidence to say whether this program is effective or not.
A joint commitment to student achievement was what led to plans like ProComp in Denver. It was initially hailed as a landmark collaboration between management and labor, but for D.C. Schools Chancellor Michelle Rhee, ProComp was too much of a compromise.
Where has that gotten us so far? Being collaborative and all holding hands and singing kumbaya. Like that, in my mind, hasn't gotten public education or these school districts anywhere. When we're dealing with kids' lives and what's in the best interest of kids, I'm not going to compromise on that, period.
Right now, public pressure to improve student performance is so strong, it may be strengthening the hand of reformers like Rhee who want new pay rules no matter what. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. We begin this hour on the campaign trail. Both presidential hopefuls were in Ohio today, trying to pick up votes in a crucial swing state this November. Barack Obama focused on education, outlining a school reform plan that includes performance-based pay for teachers. Obama was also critical of President Bush's announcement today that he is drawing down U.S. forces in Iraq. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
Senator Obama said the president's plan falls short and does not solve the central problem in Iraq, the need for political reconciliation.
In the absence of a timetable to remove our combat brigades, we will continue to give Iraq's leaders a blank check instead of pressing them to reconcile their differences. So the president's talk of return on success is a new name for continuing the same strategic mistakes that have dominated our foreign policy for over 5 years.
Obama's comments came at a Dayton area high school where he earlier gave what the campaign billed as a major policy speech. He started with a shout out to the educators in the room.
We appreciate what you do each and every day because there is no job that is more important.
Obama said candidates always say education is a top priority but don't deliver. He says the same tired debates have crippled progress and left schools and parents to fend for themselves. And he said his opponent was part of the problem.
John McCain doesn't get it. He doesn't understand that our success as a nation depends on our success in education and our success in public education. That's something I do understand.
Obama outlined an ambitious string of education proposals, more investment in early childhood education, a $4,000 college tax credit for middle-class students who agree to public service, committing resources to No Child Left Behind, and increasing school competition by funding charter schools. He also tackled the thorny issue of teacher merit, promising to recruit top talent, start performance-based pay, and...
Now, one of the things that we're going to have to do, and this is something that I know sometimes is difficult, but teachers who are doing a poor job, they've got to get extra support. But if they don't improve, then they have to be replaced.
Some in the audience were skeptical about the teacher pay proposal. Marla Bell works for the Ohio Education Association.
You know, that's just so difficult to measure, to create. We've done that, been there, and it just is a very difficult measure.
Nonetheless, she'll vote for Obama. And one of the biggest reasons, she says, is how Ohio's economy has suffered.
Well, you know, my husband and I have lived in Ohio our entire lives. And our families are here. But when our children graduate from high school, we don't know that there's a need to remain in Ohio. It almost feels like it's a dying state.
Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Dayton, Ohio.
Well, now a very different kind of change coming to many college and university campuses. To save money and energy, some schools are getting rid of that old lunchroom mainstay, the tray. Sandy Houseman of member station WVTF reports.
It's lunchtime at one of the University of Virginia's cafeterias, and third-year biology major Graydon Bowman is enjoying some of her favorite foods.
Pizza, onion rings, taco salad, and some home fries doused in some sort of cheese sauce.
But it now takes Bowman three trips through the cafeteria to amass her meal because the university no longer provides trays. Dining director Brett Barringer says the decision came after his company, food service giant Aramark, studied 25 campus cafeterias and learned it takes a half gallon of water to clean a single tray.
About 35% of the water we use goes to just washing trays. Plus, add into that the electricity to run the dish machines, the soap used, all those kinds of things. It's just absolutely huge.
At Georgia Tech, for example, managers figured they could save 3,000 gallons of water a day. And with parts of the South still battling a multi-year drought, 80% of students surveyed at UVA said they were willing to make the sacrifice, among them Caroline Higgins.
It is a little inconvenient, but at the same time, I think it's worth it for the drought and saving water.
But many students, including sophomore pre-med Amy Rogers and Matt McDonald, a second year majoring in mechanical engineering, say no trays, no way.
All I have is a soup and like a side, and I can't even carry my drink, so I miss the trays, yeah.
It wastes my energy to go back and get everything. It takes up time and it clogs all the cafeteria up with everyone walking around having to get their stuff again, whereas you can just make one trip, sit down, and then eat and leave.
But the trays are likely gone for good. Not only is their disappearance a plus for the environment, Barringer says, there are health and financial considerations. Aramark found students take about a quarter less food if they go trayless, a good thing with obesity on the rise. And he says less food is wasted.
In the average lunch, about 880 pounds of food waste was going right into the trash can.
Money saved on food and landfill charges might offset rising food and energy costs, holding the price of student meal plans down. So far, Aramark and rival Sodexo report more than 500 colleges and universities from California to Florida are on board. And Sodexo has introduced one more change in campus cafeterias, a device that prevents students from grabbing handfuls of napkins by dispensing one at a time. Sodexo spokesman Jaya Bowman says that's cut napkin use in half.
And what this has translated into in just 1 year is a savings of nearly 10 million gallons of water and more than 23,000 trees saved, 500,000 gallons of oil, and 5.5 million kilowatts of energy.
Bowman says trends often begin at universities, and this one, green dining in the cafeteria, is likely to spread to corporate locations. What's more, it's taking hold in high school lunchrooms, suggesting future college freshmen will find nothing controversial about conserving napkins and going trayless on campus. For NPR News, I'm Sandy Hausman in Charlottesville, Virginia.
This is NPR, National Public Radio. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. As Alaska's governor, Sarah Palin has been a strong supporter of programs that advocate abstinence until marriage. The vice presidential nominee also opposes explicit sex education. But Alaska's law is silent on these issues, and it has no specific budget line for sex ed. The issue is under the spotlight because of the pregnancy of Palin's 17-year-old daughter. As NPR's Brenda Wilson reports, states across the country are still struggling with the question of what to tell teenagers about sex.
Teen births in the U.S. have been declining for a while, but for the first time in 15 years, the rate of teen pregnancy was up 3% last year. As Sarah Brown of the National Campaign to Prevent Teen Pregnancy points out, 17-year-old Bristol Palin is one of about 750,000 young teenagers in the U.S. who will become pregnant this year. Her pregnancy is only the latest in a number of highly visible cases.
We had Jamie Lynn Spears, we had the teens in Gloucester, Massachusetts, and you can turn on the television any day or night and find something that allows families and communities to have a conversation with their young people and say, I want to talk to you about, once again, not just one conversation, many, why in this family we hope that you're going to delay pregnancy and childbearing until you're older.
Especially since the public debate is often rancorous and can send confusing messages to young people.
Is the message that sex is okay as long as you use protection? Is it that sex should be postponed till you're, I don't know, 22 or out of the house? Meanwhile, they're spending a lot of time together. There are a lot of them, you know, fully grown up, at least physically.
She says most Americans agree that teens should not be having sex. They just can't seem to agree about what to tell the teens that are having sex. Most states leave that decision up to the local school boards. That's true in Alaska. There's no law requiring sex education. Its largest school district, Anchorage, emphasizes abstinence. It's called Abstinence Plus. Once a semester, a teacher, student, or principal can invite experts in to talk to the class on reproductive health. Planned Parenthood gets invited in to do comprehensive sex education, but not as often as Let's Talk, an abstinence-only until marriage program that is run by Bill Donovan, the director of the Crisis Pregnancy Center in Anchorage.
Kids are, most of them are hearing both messages. You can't say that because they're hearing abstinence education, oh, they don't know anything about what they call safer sex, you know. They hear it from their health teachers. They hear it from outside groups that come in, just as we are an outside group that's invited in.
Teens like Palin's daughter, who live in small towns like Wasilla, about an hour north of Anchorage, often turn up at his crisis pregnancy center.
All the time. Not only that, they'll fly in from the bush, from the villages, and come to our center.
As for contraceptive services for teens, he neither counsels nor refers them. But Stephanie Birch, the director of Alaska's Maternal and Child Health Department, says there are public health centers and private doctors that she links teens to via the Internet.
Teenagers are pretty web savvy, and so we have a lot of our services on our website. We also have a confidential email, and I get many emails from young women or men who are seeking reproductive health services, and they can tell me which community they're from, and I can connect them with either a private provider or one of the public health centers.
According to the Allen Guttmacher Institute, a clearinghouse on reproductive health services, Alaska ranks number one in funding contraceptive services for those who need them. Sarah Brown of the National Campaign to Prevent Teen Pregnancy says that just goes to show you.
Even in the face of very good services and education, you know, sex happens, life happens.
Brenda Wilson, NPR News.